From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at the decision in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and what it could mean for the future of protest safety. Then, we'll speak with local Kenosha and Milwaukee racial justice organizers about how the verdict will impact their work.
We are concerned that some of those who have been threatening us might feel more brave, that they could actually hurt us without facing consequences. But we are just as dedicated as ever to our goal to have a reimagined Kenosha.
Plus, we'll tell you about a project to create an interactive map showing Indigenous landmarks in Milwaukee.
There's a general erasure of Indigenous peoples, presence, histories, and cultures throughout our history, but also the present. Our whole history is just erased. So this is part of my efforts to basically put Indigenous histories and cultures of Milwaukee on the map.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Last week in Kenosha, a jury found Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty on all charges. Rittenhouse was facing five charges, including intentional homicide, for killing two people and injuring one during protests in the city last summer. The case was heavily politicized by Republican and Democratic leaders, and the response to the verdict has been no different. But for many, the case and the decision have raised questions about what we consider self-defense and who is truly protected by our laws. Attorney Andrew Martinez is a founding partner at Martinez & Ruby LLP in Baraboo, and he joins me now to talk about the ruling, how we got here, and what it could mean for the future. Andrew, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
As someone who is familiar with the laws here in Wisconsin and who has been watching the trial play out, was this the verdict you were expecting?
To be honest, I wasn't sure what to expect. The length of the deliberation really gave me pause in terms of what I thought the jury was doing. My position, my opinion, which I'd expressed repeatedly while the deliberations were going on, was that the length of deliberations really suggested that the jury had moved past a total acquittal. And I really thought that they were working on compromising, deciding what charges they were going to compromise on. So I was surprised, just given how long it took them to reach a verdict, at the verdict. Looking at the strength of the presentations, though, looking at the evidence, I can't say that I'm, blown out of the water by the determination.
Sure. And that's something that's been brought up a lot in the conversations both before this decision was made and now that it has been made. The evidence that was presented in trial was, of course, not everything that the prosecution wanted to introduce. How impactful were these decisions over what was allowed to go into the trial and what wasn't?
That's the whole case, right? I mean, there's a reason that you have hours and hours and days of litigation over that kind of evidence. So, for example, in this case, the prosecution, I believe, had wanted to introduce evidence related to, there was that video that came out shortly after the shootings of Kyle Rittenhouse getting into a fist fight with, I think, a girl. I don't remember the exact details. And that was ruled inadmissible. And, I can't say that that's the wrong ruling by Judge Schrader. But at the same time, if you're a juror and this case basically presents to you the question of, is Kyle Rittenhouse a person who is violent and who went there potentially with the intent to do violence? Certainly evidence that he's been violent towards another person in the past might be relevant in that determination. So, the amount of evidence, the rulings about what evidence is admitted, that's the whole trial. I don't know that I can say that that piece of evidence in particular would change the outcome, but it certainly, I think, would be relevant to the jury.
There was another piece of evidence that was similarly looking at Rittenhouse's thoughts about using deadly force, specifically saying to a friend of his in watching someone seemingly steal something that he wished he'd had his AR-15 on him, that he'd wished he'd shot them. Why weren't these things brought into the courtroom?
Yeah, so there's a tension in criminal defense and criminal, in these kinds of cases between, on the one hand, the prosecution gets a right to put on its case. And that includes oftentimes evidence about other things that happened, other things that the defendant has done. But the defendant also has a right to have the jury consider just whatever the conduct is and what the evidence is on this particular offense. So in other words, if I'm charged with an attempt with a homicide, with a first degree intentional homicide, there is a way of thinking, which I think has a lot of merit, which is that the jury should only look at what is the evidence in this case, right? Does the state have enough evidence to prove me guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in this particular case? Now, if I'm on trial for first degree intentional homicide and I've previously been convicted of a different first degree intentional homicide, there's a risk that I get convicted not because the state proved my guilt beyond a reasonable doubt in this case, but because the jury basically thought something along the lines of, well, if he's murdered one person, he probably murdered another person. So there's a very broad rule in Wisconsin evidence rules, evidence law, that says you, the jury, are not allowed to consider whether the defendant acted in accordance with his character. In other words, the defense is not allowed to say the defendant is a bad person and therefore the defendant did this particular thing. There's obviously a lot of exceptions, and usually related similar bad conduct gets admitted in cases. I'm frankly surprised that the judge excluded these two pieces of evidence, the evidence of Kyle's prior fist fight and the evidence of his statements about explicitly wanting to use an AR-15 to punish someone that he perceived as a wrongdoer. The tension is, I don't think Judge Schrader is wrong in making that determination and excluding that evidence. The difference is that other defendants who are not Kyle Rittenhouse don't get the benefit of that rule. In other words, in any other case that is not under this amount of scrutiny, that evidence comes in. And I think that's part of the tension or part of the appeal of the case or part of the import of the case is that even if we agree that the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict is the right verdict, we have to think about what happens to a defendant similarly situated to Kyle Rittenhouse, but without the massive media attention, without the massive support from anonymous donors online, and perhaps with a different skin color.
I think we're seeing a lot of that play out right now as politicians, especially from both sides of the aisle, weigh in very differently. There's a lot of attention on this case. And it seems like what you're saying is that to some extent, as a result of this attention, Rittenhouse as a defendant was given some considerations that may not have been given to another person in his situation.
I mean, I don't think it's reasonably disputable that that's true, that Kyle Rittenhouse got the benefit of a lot of things that other clients would not have gotten the benefit of. I mean, here's a good example. He's charged with a first-degree intentional homicide, or he was charged with a first-degree intentional homicide. If you ask defense attorneys across the state of Wisconsin who handle first-degree intentional homicides how often clients of theirs are released on any amount of bond on a first-degree intentional homicide, the number is small. I believe Kyle Rittenhouse's bond was $2 million. How many defendants facing such a serious crime have access to $2 million to post? The answer is one, I think, right? So the benefit that you get as a criminal defense attorney to have your client charged with an extremely serious crime out of jail in the time leading up to the trial is enormous. You have unfettered access to your client. You can talk to your client anytime you want, wherever you want. You don't have to worry about guards or about security protocols in custody. You can run through mock interviews, right, or mock cross-examinations. I'm confident that Kyle Rittenhouse was probably one of the most well-prepared criminal defense attorneys ever for a cross-examination, and that just cannot happen as well when you have a client who's behind bars. I talked about the fact that I think Judge Schrader probably made the right call with respect to what's called other acts evidence with respect to Kyle. I think he got a break there. But also, you know, just being out in the world is itself an enormous benefit to him.
You're listening to Lake Effect. This is Joy Powers, and I'm speaking with attorney Andrew Martinez about the ruling in the Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha. Rittenhouse was being attacked by people who had just seen him kill someone else. But the actions of Rittenhouse's victims seemingly weren't seen as self-defense, but rather an attack. And I guess I don't understand, just as somebody who's not as familiar with law, should it have mattered why these victims were going after Rittenhouse? Or is that not something that is brought into this larger calculation of whether or not this was self-defense?
Yeah, I think what's one of the things that's most interesting and possibly one of the things that's most like legally complicated about the case is just, so Mr. Huber, Mr. Grosskreutz, and Mr. Rittenhouse, I legitimately believe that at different points in their interactions that night, each of them had the right to either defend themselves or defend others. I don't say that with respect to Mr. Rosenbaum, because obviously his was the most controversial. And regardless of what happened immediately before it, there's clear evidence that Mr. Rosenbaum was chasing Mr. Rittenhouse at some point. But at least with respect to the others, right, it doesn't seem to me that it was disputed that the reason that these other people were confronting Mr. Rittenhouse is because, at least subjectively, they believed that he had just killed someone and was trying to get away, right? And not to mention, he still has his gun. He's still walking in a crowd of people. And so, you know, self-defense was the primary issue in this case. There is something called defense of others, and it basically is the exact same standard. If you believe that a third person is in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm, you're allowed to use potentially deadly force to protect others. So the question is, Mr. Grosskreutz and Mr. Huber, did they reasonably believe that Kyle Rittenhouse presented a danger to other people? I think that based on the information available to them, it's undisputed that they did. So let's flip the script and say that in a hypothetical situation where Mr. Grosskreutz had shot and killed Kyle Rittenhouse, would he have been privileged to do so as a matter of self-defense? I think there's a very, very strong argument there too. Now, Mr. Huber isn't charged because he passed away. Mr. Grosskreutz isn't charged with respect to that. So it's this weird situation where I legitimately believe that certainly now the jury has spoken with respect to Mr. Rittenhouse, he's innocent. If Mr. Grosskreutz had been charged with a crime, he also, I think, had a strong claim to self-defense or defense of others. Had Mr. Huber survived, I think the same is true for him. He would have had a strong claim for self-defense or defense of others. And so what that leaves us is the law is written in such a way where we have this melee, this confrontation between two armed people, people armed with guns. I guess one of the central issues was whether a skateboard is a deadly weapon. Two people armed with guns, a third person trying to intervene to take a person who has just killed someone into custody or to subdue them to make sure he doesn't hurt anybody else. And all of them are privileged to use deadly force. I think the fact that there's a strong argument that that is the case, that all three of these people had the privilege to use deadly force, suggests that our laws are perhaps not written as clearly as they should be.
It does seem like, to some extent, whoever wins the gun battle, whoever wins this melee, essentially wins the day. Now, this ruling, it doesn't seem like it's going to have a big impact on self-defense, but could it have an impact on how we interpret our self-defense law in the future?
Sure. So first of all, I think that there are a lot of people for whom this case did represent the question of whether or not self-defense still exists in America. And I'm not one of those people. I don't share that concern. But certainly, I think that there are people who absolutely have that concern. Second, I mean, this has to be, if you are a prosecutor and you're looking at a potential self-defense case, you have to be reevaluating your self-defense, how you're weighing the self-defense defense in your cases right now. Because I definitely believe that in the hands of different prosecutors, this would have gone a different way. I definitely believe that prosecutors could have made different choices that would have resulted in some convictions. I think that the way that the prosecution here presented their case forced the jury to either say self-defense is real or self-defense is not. And I just don't think that's the right way to approach it. I think that there's no question that self-defense survives, certainly. But more importantly, the verdict doesn't set any legal precedent. But this is probably the most publicized case in Wisconsin history. And so it is beyond dispute that prosecutors, defense attorneys, defendants, and potential future jurors are aware of this case. And in their mind, there's certainly the possibility of a belief that says, if Kyle Rittenhouse can walk into Kenosha armed with a gun and shoot one unarmed person, a person armed with a skateboard, and a person who was just trying to stop him after he'd shot a bunch of other people, then self-defense is broader than we previously conceived of it as being.
The concerns among many now is that this verdict will embolden so-called vigilantes, or really domestic terrorists, to kill more people at protests. What could this ruling mean for the safety of protests here in Wisconsin in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think the opposite would have been sent a stronger message. If Mr. Rittenhouse had been convicted, I think that would have said more about the amount of safety that protesters are entitled to. In other words, if 12 people collectively said, Mr. Rittenhouse, your behavior at these protests was completely out of line, then I think that would have sent a direct message to vigilantes, to right-wing extremists, to counter-protesters, to whoever, saying, at the end of the day, property damage does not excuse murder or the taking of human life. That message obviously didn't get sent by a not guilty verdict. To the extent to which right-wing believers are going to be emboldened by this, I think is up in the air right now. But I can tell you that from what I've seen online, it's definitely the case that they take this as a total victory and a total vindication of their position. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
Attorney Andrew Martinez is a founding partner of Martinez & Ruby LLP in Baraboo, and he spoke with me about the verdict and implications of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha. When we come back, we'll hear how Kenosha community members and activists are reacting to the trial and verdict. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Our coverage continues now of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha and the jury's decision last week to acquit him of all charges. The steps of the Kenosha County Courthouse were full of people as the decision came down. Some were there in support of Rittenhouse. Others were there in support of the men he killed or wounded, and their families. Here's how some of them reacted to the verdict. We'll hear first from Justin Blake, the uncle of Jacob Blake, who was shot by a Kenosha police officer.
Our heart is broken for their family. We've given our total effort from LOC, Leaders of Kenosha, from Rainbow Push, from the Blake family, to do everything that we could to prop them up. So all they had to do was worry about their families in this case. This is a tragic day in the history of this country, where we sweep away the charges of carrying an illegal weapon, which clearly was an illegal weapon for a 17-year-old to have, not allowing certain evidence in that the jury, we're out here, we don't know what they saw, but we know what was denied for them to see. And if that denied them carrying out justice, then it shows you that this was a total mockery of what justice should be. There's no way he should be going home. Our personal opinion is he should have been going to jail.
What do you think is going to happen in the streets here today? What sort of reaction do you expect?
Well, man, I don't know. Everybody's going to be a little upset when they hear it, understandably. This is the second shooting in this city that no charges was filed on. My nephew was shot 7 times in the back by a police officer with his children sitting right there in the back seat. No charges were levied in this racist town. No charges are levied for the 2 young men that were out marching in support of Jacob Blake and what they saw. This is for this city, county, and state, you can't market this city anymore as the city by the lake. This is like a sundown town where you don't welcome minorities, where you don't welcome African Americans, and African Americans will know to stay the hell up out of here.
It's so great that this ended with an acquittal instead of a mistrial or a hung jury, because there's such a finality for Kyle, and there's such a finality for everybody to say, you know, really, we're packing it up and we're leaving. There is no more, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse and guilty or not guilty. He's not guilty, and the acquittal makes it final. There was so much evidence for self-defense. And, you know, in this video camera phone age, there were so many people with good videos, and the witness and the evidence that made the most difference for me looking at the jury and seeing their reaction was Drew Hernandez. It was really compelling to have somebody who said, I was standing right there from this position, witness to all these different events, and I have this video evidence to support everything I'm saying. And it was important with all this evidence for acquittal that the jury not act politically. The jury, you know, followed their orders from the judge. And he has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And proving him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt just was never there.
Well, I am really out here because when I found out about the verdict, it's hard for everybody to witness this. Like, it's not right. And like I've been saying this whole time, a life is a life. Right is right and wrong is wrong. And this should go against everybody's morals and values. It should. And it's not fair. It's not fair at all to anybody that lives here. Now everybody that lives here is going to be on eggshells because, I mean, this can happen again. Like, somebody else can get killed. And are they going to let another murder off? This sends a message that we need to protect ourselves. We need to protect ourselves no matter what, because if he can protect himself like that, and they're saying, oh, because he was being attacked, he wasn't being attacked. I was there that night. He was not being attacked. They tried to take the gun because they said there was an active shooter in the area. He was not supposed to have the gun. He was not supposed to be in the area. He's not a Wisconsin resident. He's not from here. How is it okay? And how did he go home and sleep in his bed peacefully that night?
The Rittenhouse trial served as yet another example of the division in this country. It stirred intense feelings and reaction, especially among local activists and social justice organizers in Wisconsin, who are fighting against racial and systemic inequity. One of those organizations is Leaders of Kenosha. Their work is focused on bringing community members together to reimagine Kenosha to make it genuinely inclusive for everyone who lives there. Last week after the verdict, the organization hosted an event filled with music and food and offered a space for those who needed it to heal. Erica Ness is the Director of Community Engagement for Leaders of Kenosha. Omar Flores is the co-chair of the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, which is collaborating with Leaders of Kenosha. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about the impact of the Rittenhouse trial and what it means for the future of their work.
We were on the courthouse steps when the verdict was read. We definitely felt a lot of disappointment. I think that sometimes it is easy to be cynical, like, well, that's what we expected. Regardless of the verdict, we do not have faith that our current legal system can bring about justice, but you don't really know how hard it's going to hit you until it happens. To just hear the not guilty over and over again in reference to, you know, Anthony Huber and JoJo Rosenbaum and Kyle killing them, to hear that was really, really hard. And to watch the, you know, cheers from the supporters of Kyle Rittenhouse talk about, like, yeah, this is America, and excited and cheering about how the only people that did anything wrong that night were the people who were at home on the couch, that himself and all the people there supporting Kyle should have been there with Kyle in the first place, shooting people as well. Like, that was really, really hard to watch, because while we know that justice can't be brought in this case, Anthony's dead, JoJo's dead, there's no real justice to be done when two people's lives can't be brought back. But we also felt that it was very important that a precedent be set that, you know, you can't just carry an assault style rifle into a community and shoot and kill two protesters. But instead, it would appear that the precedent is being set that you can do that. So that's very frightening for us. We've already had a lot of people we know be threatened, be followed home, have a lot of really scary experiences from those that align themselves with Kyle Rittenhouse. And now for this verdict to come out the way it did, we feel like it just emboldens them. And we've already watched a lot of people on the courthouse steps kind of confirm that fear for us.
Well, my initial reaction and my reaction right now still is a lot of anger, essentially, because, I mean, we've all had to defuse situations where people were violent with us, especially those of us that have been marching for racial justice. It's not uncommon that somebody will, like, pull over their car and, you know, flash a gun or, you know, try and run you over. I mean, things like that. And what we're all kind of angry about and afraid about now is that, you know, those threats are going to be carried out and they're going to get away with it. And they're going to become more frequent because they know they're going to get away with it.
That's definitely a real fear. That's definitely a real fear for your own safety. And Erica, as a Kenosha organizer, what does this verdict mean now within the work that you, your organization, Leaders of Kenosha, and the communities you organize with now? What does this verdict mean moving forward?
Yeah, this verdict doesn't change our work. It makes us have to be more cautious. We are concerned that some of those who have been threatening us for a long time might feel more brave, that they could actually hurt us without facing consequences, as Kyle has not faced consequences after killing two people and maiming another. But we are just as dedicated as ever to our goal to have a reimagined Kenosha in which there is equitable access to opportunities, in which racism is no longer embedded in all of our systems, in which people aren't suffering from homelessness and poor housing and lack of resources as they are now. Our legal system is still one that I wouldn't even say it's broken. It's set up exactly how it was designed a long, long time ago to keep white killers free and innocent people of color killed or locked up. So that needs to change, and we will still be working as hard as ever to make those changes.
Omar, as a Milwaukee organizer collaborating and in solidarity and working with Kenosha organizers, working statewide with other organizers, what does this verdict mean now in your work and in the communities that you organize with?
You know, I'm an organizer in Milwaukee, but I grew up and started organizing in Kenosha. I had hosted a rally here in 2014 in response to what was happening in Ferguson. And so, you know, what you realize is that across cities, sure, the issues are different, you know, but they all come from the same sources. And usually that's from over-policing, from vigilante white people. And I think it makes sense for us to collaborate with Kenosha organizations just because, you know, we're facing the same enemy a lot of the time. And, you know, whether that's here or there, you know, what's the famous quote that an injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere? You know, that's kind of the approach that we take, because honestly, the Rittenhouse case means a lot to Milwaukee residents. We do a lot of canvassing on both the south and the north sides of the city. And, you know, it's something that actually gets brought up pretty often. We were talking with people actually about the sheriff's overtime budget. But often, you know, especially on the north side, we would talk with a lot of people that had really bad encounters with police. I mean, just countless stories of, I mean, even 12-year-olds being harassed by Milwaukee Police Department. And, you know, something that's often brought up, it's like, well, you know, you look at that kid, Kyle, he literally killed somebody and tried to turn himself in and the cops didn't even bat an eye. Like, you have 12-year-old black children existing on the north side, just existing, not doing anything wrong. And they're being harassed by police, like 5 or 6 squads on them. And so, you know, the double standard is so obvious, especially compared to area codes like the 53206 area code that's like the most incarcerated. And so the people are really feeling this, whether they're from Kenosha or not.
I want to touch on to what you had mentioned earlier, Erica. You've all been gathering leaders of Kenosha and other Wisconsin and Kenosha-based organizations. You've been physically out gathering together in community with each other throughout the trial and really reimagining, what the future of Kenosha and Wisconsin could look like. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yes. Reimagine Kenosha is a campaign that's based on the love and care and community that we already have here and taking that love and care to the policy level. We've launched the Reimagine Kenosha campaign in partnership with other organizations and activists, like you said, Black Leaders Organizing Communities. We had support from for Future Wisconsin this week with our events launching the campaign. And we will keep, you know, moving forward with our mission to rid racism and oppression from our system. But we also want to continue with our efforts that we started last summer in increasing civic engagement in Kenosha, making it easier for people to know who their representatives are, easier for people to vote, easier for people to run for office so that we can have more diverse representation, easier for people to access education so we can have more diverse lawyers, more diverse judges, so that a judge like Judge Schrader doesn't run unopposed in the future, because these are things that we can change. And there's a very real reason that so many people believe that they can't change and that they won't. But our job now is to support our community while things haven't changed and keep making it possible that they can.
Omar, with this verdict now and with your work in organizing, how will this impact how you see the work being done at a statewide level?
Yeah, so I mean, the state has always kind of been a huge boundary for us, because honestly, there's a lot of state laws that kind of prevent us from being able to get what we want. One of those things being community control of the police. There's lots of statutes in the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. And there's also a lot of stuff in the statutes around the FPC being a requirement in cities. That all of that prevents us from being able to accomplish what we essentially want, which is community control of the police through CPAC. CPAC stands for Civilian Police Accountability Council. And that would essentially be where elected citizens that are not in any way related to the police, they're elected to decide funding for the police, to decide how many police there are, how they're policed, who's policing them. And so we just want, you know, the police to be under full control, you know, by the community. When you ask, like, you know, well, how does this impact our work on a state level? I think that just shows the urgency needed behind, like, changing state laws, and so that we were able to actually see some lawful change.
The last question that I want to leave off on is for the both of you. Why do you continue to do this work towards racial justice and equity and breaking down systemic and structural racism?
This work is long. It's challenging. It can be very demoralizing when we continue to see our systems fail us and for oppression and racism to continue and to win in situations like the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse case. And as a white ally, I can't begin to imagine how hard it is for people who actually are affected by structural racism personally every day. So I'm very grateful to the people who I work alongside of who go through that pain to continue to fight for justice. I can't watch a child like this end this way. I can't watch my friends and colleagues and associates be threatened. I can't watch little kids. I can't stop fighting. And I really do believe when I'm standing here with hundreds of other community members who are so dedicated to this fight, who put so much work into it, and as I see these little wins here and there, I can't help but continue to believe that we will be able to make change. And we will see a reimagined Kenosha, because we already have it within our own community. It's just about making it so across the board.
Well, you know, when I first started organizing, I honestly came into it a bit naive. I thought it was going to be easy, and that, you know, most people could agree that it's really messed up that Black and brown children are shot and killed by the police and nothing happens. Unfortunately, that's not the case. There's a lot of people that think that's okay. So I guess what I learned is that, you know, organizing takes hard grassroots work. You know, the Milwaukee Alliance, we're not a nonprofit. We're not funded by random anonymous donors. And then we have to say, go vote for this person. We're completely funded by membership dues and by people that support the cause. I guess when you know that the only way to change things is through direct action, you know, it doesn't feel like a choice to stop. I don't think I could stop if I tried. The work is stressful. The work is difficult. And sure, there are some days where I really wish I just didn't take it up. But, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way, because otherwise it's just going to keep happening. If you ever want to feel motivated to do this work, just know that it's not going to get done without you.
Erica Ness is the Director of Community Engagement for Leaders of Kenosha. Omar Flores is the co-chair of the Milwaukee Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. We have much more coverage of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and verdict, including an explanation of why the underage gun possession charge was thrown out and how both attorneys reacted to the outcome of the trial. You can find all of it at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll dig into the history of the Billy the Brownie radio show and find out if it's something just us Wisconsinites remember. But first, we'll tell you about a project that Marquette students are working on to identify the many indigenous landmarks around Milwaukee. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. American Family Field, the Milwaukee Art Museum, the Mitchell Park Domes. These are all places Milwaukeeans enjoy regularly. But few know the indigenous history beneath them. A group of students at Marquette University, led by Associate Professor Brian Reinfleisch, have created an online interactive map that shows the indigenous history of different places around Milwaukee. Lake Effect's Beck Andrew Salgado sat down with Reinfleisch to learn more about the project.
What made you guys want to start a project like this, and how did you go about doing it?
That's a great question. It actually started about 4 or 5 years ago. I took part in a symposium put on by the National Endowment for the Humanities for Digital Native American Studies. And so I'm a practitioner. I'm a student of Native American history, Native American studies, but I've never had much engagement with like digital humanities. And so I went to this sort of like symposium, and they sort of challenged us to sort of marry the two together and to really, in practice, particularly like focus on what digital humanities can do for indigenous communities themselves beyond just, you know, like my scholarship, but what can it do for the communities themselves? And so the one thing that I've always done when I've interacted with communities around Milwaukee is that it's always about going and educating my people, basically, right? So white people, right? Like there's a general erasure of indigenous peoples, presence, histories, and cultures throughout our history, but also the present. I mean, all you have to do is go to the Milwaukee airport, right, Mitchell? And you have the slogan, the good land, and all those t-shirts that shows the stereotypes that we still have about indigenous peoples. Our whole history is just erased and still is, which is just crazy. So this is part of my efforts to basically put indigenous histories and cultures of Milwaukee, both in the past, present, and future, on the map, quite literally. So I just want to showcase basically, what the indigenous past has been here in Milwaukee and how it shaped Milwaukee, but also how it continues to shape Milwaukee.
Yeah. And one of the things that I was really struck by when I started reading more about the project that you guys were working on is just how accessible and really in some ways just fun it makes learning about indigenous history. And how did that kind of come about as far as making this very steeped in this digital atmosphere of, hey, this is the project, we're going to put it on a map and you can go to different various parts of Milwaukee and look at it?
Yeah, so it's part of my frustrations as being an instructor here at Marquette, because whenever I teach my indigenous courses, it's basically a re-education course for every single student that enters, unless they're indigenous. And then in some cases, it still is an education course for them. And just correcting the narrative, right? Correcting what they've been given through K through 12. And I felt like the general public needs that as well. And so I wanted to demonstrate again, through a map of showing like the places where we walk every day or the places we even call home or the places where we call work are shaped by indigenous past, but also in the present, and then hopefully for the future as well. And so all of this came to sort of a head last summer, or this past summer, when we sort of formed this collective known as the Indigeneity Lab. And it was a series of three different projects. It was my project, but then also a project related to the boarding schools for Catholic missions. So like the entire Catholic church's boarding schools, which is really a hot trending topic right now. Yeah. We have those records at Marquette. And so one of our students was perusing through all those records. And then another one was exploring the potential of actually reintroducing wild rice into the Menominee River Valley, which is really cool, right? Like, yeah. The Menominee River Valley used to be prime wild rice land and swampland, but through industrialization, wiped that out. And we're trying to explore the ethical ways of reintroducing that. So those three projects together created this indigeneity lab and allowed me to realize my vision for sort of, you know, again, educating the broader public about what is indigenous Milwaukee and how it continues to be sort of central to this area.
Yeah, most definitely. And as far as these various places on the map that you guys have made, how did you go about finding and collecting and then eventually proliferating the information for every spot? Then I can't even imagine how much data y'all were working with to have to put on a singular map.
It's funny. It's sort of like multifaceted for me. Is like I actually use my my undergraduate honors classes to actually research these sites. And then I also analyze the sites myself and edit their entries along with the other individuals that are working on this project. And so that's sort of like the research for the project. And from there, after that, we sort of integrate those into whatever we can find from the Milwaukee newspapers, historical newspapers that we can access on campus. And so that's how we sort of find all the various sites. So right now we have about 140 sites that we want to do. And like my ultimate goal is to sort of like populate the map. So it's just so overwhelming for an audience. Like you can't take away anything other than the fact that this is like indigenous land and still is. Like that's the hope. But right now we only have about 20 entries. Okay. But the ones that I wanted to start with was sort of like the big ones, like, you know, Indian Community School. Sort of the protests around the American Indian movement at the Milwaukee Public Library, the things that we can make really visible about, if you're in Milwaukee, you probably know these areas or you've walked past them or you've seen them.
Yeah. And to kind of dovetail off that a little bit, you've touched on it already, but what is the importance of reframing the way that Milwaukeeans look at Milwaukee historically? And why is that so important?
I think because, again, it goes back to the general erasure of indigenous peoples in our textbooks and our histories. I mean, you take the common person off the street and, you know, they think of Native Americans, they sometimes think, well, they're extinct, right? Or they think about the Plains Indians like the Lakota, the Dakota peoples and Custer and Little Bighorn. This is what they're thinking. And at the same time, we never think about indigenous peoples as in modernity, like existing alongside us. With us, right? Dressing just like us, acting just like us, taking things their own way, but then morphing them in the ways that are, you know, just good for themselves. And so, I mean, it's not just about correction of erasure within the histories themselves, but just celebrating those peoples when they have been told throughout all of American history that they shouldn't be celebrated, that they don't matter.
Yeah. And another thing I was wondering is, as you've done your research and you've accumulated more information and you've kind of cultivated this project from an idea into something that is, you know, very soon going to be accessible by the public, how has the indigenous community in Milwaukee responded to your doing this? And you know, what is the response been and what does it mean to indigenous people in Milwaukee?
The big thing for me from the beginning has always been about, right, when I, you know, the entire reason I got into American Indian Studies in the first place is to do something for a community. Not my own, I mean, like I'm doing things for my own community by educating them. Great. But like empowering indigenous communities in one way as well. And the one thing that often gets left out of the histories is that when we think of indigenous peoples, we think of reservations, but we don't think of urban centers like Milwaukee and Chicago, where actually more than 50% of indigenous peoples live. They live off reservation as opposed to on reservation. Wow. And so how do we empower those communities when there's sort of this great mix of so many different indigenous identities and cultures and peoples that they don't have sort of their own central community unless they have an American Indian Center like they do in Chicago? We don't here. And so one of my goals was to empower the community to be a part of this project, maybe take ownership at some point, but also to be involved in the process. And so intimate to this project is that the student researchers that have been doing this are actually indigenous students at Marquette. In fact, many of the liaisons who are interacting with this work are also indigenous themselves. I'm the only non-indigenous person sort of involved in this project at this point. But we also wanted to conduct interviews for each and every one of these sites. And we wanted to do that with community people, community experts, community who have knowledge about, you know, the history as well as the continued legacy of these sites that we're looking at. And so we want to get the experts, we want to get the community involved in this process. And again, this is why this is a multi-year project, because ultimately when it comes to thinking about this project. Right now, it's more thinking about how do we educate Milwaukeeans about Indigenous past, present, and future. But then for the future, I want it to be more about Indigenous communities speaking to Milwaukeeans and the greater Milwaukee area.
Yeah, most definitely. And I know that we've already established that, you know, the site will get up by the end of the year and it's going to have 20 entries. But looking into the future, because I know that this is something a little bit bigger and a project that you want to continue doing, and I believe you said have over 100 entries. What does the future look like for this site? And even within Marquette, how do you plan to keep that going?
This project is sort of like it reflects me in a way in which I continue to evolve as a teacher, a researcher, but also as a community activist. In terms of that, as I develop relationships, as I get to know people in the community, though, that will be reflected in the project as they continue to bring the knowledge. As I get to know the community, they get to know this project. And so again, like at the end game of this, like when do we call it quits? I don't know, maybe 10 years down the road when, again, that entire map is just filled and it's just overwhelming. Yeah. Or maybe it never ends, right? Like we're continually placing because Indigenous peoples and communities continue to evolve just like everything else. So that would be my ultimate end goal, I think.
Brian Rindfleisch is an associate professor of history at Marquette University. He spoke to Lake Effect's Beck Andrew Salgado about restoring Indigenous history through his interactive map project.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
It's not quite time for the holidays, but for people who grew up in Milwaukee between the 1930s and 1950s, this might sound familiar.
Hi, greetings and bend an ear for the busiest program of the year.
That's right, Billy.
Billy the Brownie, that is. For more than 20 years, families gathered around their radios during the holidays to hear the Billy the Brownie show. It featured Billy, Santa Claus, and Captain Larry. Mary Pat Vigil, who grew up on the northwest side of Milwaukee in the 50s, remembers anticipating every broadcast with her siblings. She was the youngest of three.
We would be sitting at our kitchen table, but we knew Billy the Brownie was coming on at a certain time. So we would finish our dinner and run to the radio. And I still picture whoever got there first. We had a little chair and just one little chair. So whoever got there first got the chair. But otherwise, we would sit on the floor and put our ears right up to the radio.
She says it was like a storytelling session. And her memories of the Billy the Brownie radio show prompted her to submit this question to Bubbler Talk.
Was Billy the Brownie a local radio program in the 50s or early 50s, or was that a national radio program?
Well, the short answer is no. Billy the Brownie was not broadcast nationally. It was broadcast locally, and the show was quite popular here in Milwaukee. Schuster's Department Store introduced the Billy the Brownie character in 1927 to promote its annual Christmas parade. Billy was based on Palmer Cox's Scottish folk characters called Brownies. They were little elf-like people invisible to humans. Turnout for Schuster's Christmas parade was lackluster, so management decided to create a radio show with Billy as the star. The 15-minute show aired Monday through Friday and on Sundays from 1931 to 1955. Ben Barbera, the curator of the Milwaukee County Historical Society, says the Billy the Brownie show was the highlight of the Christmas season for a lot of Milwaukee children.
So the Schuster's holiday parade was always the first Saturday after Thanksgiving. And they would start running the Billy the Brownie show about 10 days before that. And so the first 10 days of the show, he would be chronicling Santa's trip, his journey to Milwaukee for the parade. And there would always be some sort of disaster, whether it be a storm or a sick reindeer or something dramatic would happen.
And Barbera says once Santa Claus arrived for the parade, the show continued until Christmas Eve. Billy also read children's letters to Santa and short stories on air. Barbera says Santa received 50 to 70,000 letters annually. In 1947, they received 100,000. When the Billy the Brownie radio show ended in 1955, Billy went on a trip around the world, so the story goes. He came back under new management.
Gimbel's acquired Schuster's in 1961 and all the rights to Billy the Brownie in the process. And so then in 1973, Gimbel's decided to bring Billy the Brownie back. they kind of recreated Billy. They made him much cuter, more of a sort of a pixie-like character. It's more similar to what we would think of as an elf.
But Billy did not return to radio. Barbera says Gimbels thought radio would not have the reach and television was too expensive. So Billy mostly appeared in print ads, and if he was in person, a teenage boy dressed as him. Gimbels donated its Billy the Brownie collection to the Milwaukee County Historical Society in 1984. Barbera says he thinks the Billy the Brownie show was popular because it took off just as radio popularity was growing, and during its run, made people feel good during difficult times in the United States, like the Great Depression and World War II. He says Billy the Brownie hit a sweet spot for people. Hopefully, for those of you listening, that sweet spot is still there. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
May he swoop down and bless you with the sweetest dreams.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union and Palermo's Pizza. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at the looming pension crisis here in Milwaukee and how it could affect city services. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.